I'm Strange Jason of 6 Foot Plus, found online at the number 6FTPLUS.com. Do you hear that? That sound? It sounds like, yes, it's the sound of you getting schooled, because you're listening to the Faculty of Horror.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Faculty of Horror, podcasting from the horrid halls of academia. Welcome to our fourth episode. I'm Alex West with
Andrea Subisati.
And we are here to answer the age-old question, do you like scary movies? I mean, we like scary movies. I like scary movies. Andrea?
I like scary movies to a fault, I'd say.
Yes, one of your many, many faults. And so we thought this is a question, as you know, two horror writers and people involved in the industry to a certain extent, we get asked these kind of questions a lot. Why do you get scared? How can you stand it? So we thought for this episode, we would watch the movies that scare us the most, or certainly the ones we call on when people ask us this question. So for today's episode, we are coming to you from under the blanket I had as a child. I'm clutching several teddy bears, and we're going to just see what happens and talk about some of the things that have scared us repeatedly, how they affect us now. And we also have some guests on the show that we are very excited to have, and we will be bringing in their input in a little bit.
And another reason we wanted to do this show was to really offer up a really personal and subjective account of horror. You know, we talk a whole lot about movies and we give explanations for why these movies are effective or feminist or this or that based on theory, based on, you know, sociology and psychology and feminist theory and what have you. But for this show, we really just wanted to focus on what scares you personally, and it might not have a good reason why, or it might. So that's what we wanted to talk about today.
I definitely remember my first encounter with people being really scared had to do with horror movies, certainly in a tangible way, in a way I could understand. You know, it wasn't that, not like my fears now of like, oh no, rent's due next week, which is a fear. So if anyone wants to send me money, you know, I'll leave my address on the Facebook. But it was that sense of, you know, I think we've all been to those sleepovers when we were a kid, and at some point, someone has a great idea to rent a scary movie. And I remember there was always this gamut in the group of girls that I would have these sleepovers with, and they would, one of them would be terrified and in a corner crying. A couple of them would think it was just the stupidest thing in the world. And I was always somewhere in between. I was usually scared, but I really wanted to watch it, and I just didn't know if I could finish it. And you know what? I'll fess up. I was really happy a few of the times that the girl crying won out and we had to turn off the movie. I don't know if that was for the best, because I think it resulted in some pretty, you know, heinous nightmares because we never finished the movies. So I think one thing we'll probably come to again and again in this podcast is that maybe the fear of the unknown is perhaps the scariest thing of all.
This is going to sound kind of funny coming from not only a horror fan, but a horror journalist and writer and scholar. But one of my earliest memories of horror was, believe it or not, I used to be a Girl Scout. I used to be a brownie, and then I was a girl guide. And one time we had this overnight slumber party thing. It wasn't camping or anything. We weren't in the woods. We were in a gymnasium of some friggin' church or something. And there was a whole bunch of us. And this is around the age where girls start getting really cliquey. So there was a tiny little clique of girls who were in control or something. They were somehow the bosses of everybody, and they decided that they wanted to tell scary stories. And this is after we were kind of like, you know, locked in the gym, like, go to bed. And some of the younger girls got scared and got upset and started crying. And I was the one who championed for them and insisted that the scary movies stop or else I'm going to go tell. You know, yeah, exactly. I was that guy, which is incredibly hard to believe in certain respects because I love scary stories. But on the other hand, I didn't quite care for the social intimidation aspect of it that was going on. So that's a pretty early memory for me.
I have a vague, vague memory of this, but my mom remembers this very clearly. And I think it's one of the stories from my childhood that she likes most. So one of the first movies I ever saw in theaters, my parents took me to, obviously, and it was Edward Scissorhands. And within probably the first 10 or so minutes, when Vincent Price passes away and Edward Scissorhands becomes this kind of recluse up in this tower, I started getting really, really, really scared. Just the imagery, the thought of losing a parent, it was all, it's pretty intense when you're about, gosh, 4 or 5. And so my dad, who is a filmmaker, and my mom's also, she's a writer as well, my dad sat with me and explained how, very quietly, how all the special effects could be done and that it really wasn't real and that the actor is still very much alive and well, or he was at that point. And my dad had worked with Vincent Price, and he's actually a really nice man, and I probably really like him. So it was, I had this kind of, you know, inside source, you know, someone who explains away all this stuff. Didn't stop me from being scared for the rest of my childhood. Another very traumatic moment for me was Ernest Scared Stupid. Yep. There's a part where a girl is lying, and they're all being chased by these demon woodland things, and a girl's lying in bed, and she looks under her bed, and nothing's there, and she turns around, and the thing is there, and it gets her. I, because of that movie, slept facing my wall, tucked in as tight as I could for years on end.
I think the first movie I saw that scared me, it was Terminator 2.
Come with me if you want to live.
And I had an interview a long time ago. I think it was when my book first came out, and it was for the Rue Morgue blog, actually, that they asked me what the first scary movie I ever saw was, and I said that, and I got so much flack for, that's not even a horror movie. And I remember just being like, who the fuck cares? It scared the bejesus out of me. And if you're going to tell a little kid that those, like, skinless robot skeletons aren't terrifying, like, really? And what we're going to get into today is that it doesn't quite have to be a horror movie to be horrifying. It doesn't have to be a scary movie to have a scary scene in it that affects us. And I think a common thread that we'll find when we talk to everybody and when we get the interview data in is that more often than not, it's a scene and a moment in a movie that really affects us more so than the overall thing. But we'll get into that shortly.
And this wouldn't be a Faculty of Horror podcast without a little bit of theory, maybe some data, maybe some facts. So I'm going to run you through with Andrea a couple of things that we've culled together to talk about the basic elements of fear and some of the most popular theories to do with fear. So there is an article online, which I will post to our Facebook. Please like us on Facebook if you haven't, and then you can get all these great articles. But it basically breaks down the 5 ways we are scared. Any fear we have can be attributed to one of these 5 things. And the article actually opens with a really great basic definition of fear, which I'm going to read off now. So fear is an anxious feeling caused by our own anticipation of some event imagined or experienced. Pretty standard, right? But it kind of calls in every aspect of human experience. Whether it's real, whether it's imagined, we're going to be scared. And scared is, you know, it's a survival tactic, you know, and that's how we've come as far as we have in the human race. And the 5 elements of fear is, one, extinction, so fear of death, fear of mutilation, so that would be pain, loss of autonomy, so that would be loss of control, inability to use your mind or your limbs, something like that, fear of separation, so fear of rejection, and then the final fear is ego death, so fear of humiliation, if you will. And now we're going to talk about some framing techniques that a couple of philosophers and thinkers have come up with. So you might recognize some of these names. And again, as I was saying, we are really using this as a framing device. So this has come up as part of our research, and maybe you'll find it interesting. So one of the first concepts I wanted to talk about was Freud's The Uncanny. Now, Freud's theory of the uncanny is something that is familiar, but also foreign or distorted at the same time. So that leaves us, the viewer or the person viewing the object, feeling uncomfortable as we are unable or unwilling to reconcile the two images in one entity. We are unable to process that in a way that makes sense to us. So therefore, it becomes kind of a source of fear and of discomfort. So sometimes this fear of the uncanny gets brought up when they, you know, those news shows where they show those images of the Japanese doll lifelike things, the robots that are so lifelike, and that there's something kind of always sinister about them and we can't reconcile. So as technology progresses, we see a bit more of that kind of uncanniness where a machine is able to mimic something that we see as so human. But cognitively, we know it's not human. We know it's a machine that's just able to replicate something that we want to see.
Right. The uncanny came up a little bit in my research on zombies when I encountered something called the Uncanny Valley. And that was something coined by a roboticist, actually, named Matahashi Mori, I believe. God, I hope so. And what he did was basically is he charted out kind of on a line graph how we tend to like things that are familiar to us and that resemble us. And we like them to a certain point and we like them to a certain point. We like little kids like teddy bears because they're kind of, you know, humanoid shaped. And then you kind of like dolls because they're a bit more humanoid shaped. But then there's a huge valley right before you get to actual humanity where something is really familiar to us but not quite us, and it actually instills a huge feeling of dread. And it's the funny thing is that it's often totally accidental. For example, I was dating somebody who had a small child for a little while, and he was absolutely terrified of the Polar Express. And here's this, you know, this Disney kids movie that, you know, with Tom Hanks, but like everybody is kind of CGI digitized, and it really weirded him out. And I thought that that was so interesting. And it's also something I see in, I don't know if you've seen that Bjork video with the All Is Full of Love. Oh, yeah. With the robots. Gives you the fucking creeps. So there's a lot of examples of the uncanny and the uncanny valley. And it's something that's kind of really fun to look for.
I also think it kind of comes into play with one of the movies from last year that really affected me was probably The Woman in Black. And it's that figure of a woman that's kind of off to the side and her face is obscured. And you get the sense that it's just kind of decayed. But we all know what a skull looks like, and it's nothing we don't have, you know, underneath our skin and flesh. But it was so disturbing to me. It really chilled me to the bone. It really, really like caused a lot of anxiety and a lot of sleepless nights.
I was reading an article online today. Maybe I can find it and post the link. But anyone who knows me knows that I am deathly terrified of spiders. And it was a link that describes why people are afraid of spiders. That it's kind of a physiological explanation that has to do with the way they move, the way they're built, their symmetry, and the way human beings are conditioned to have an especially keen awareness of things that happen out of the corner of their eyes. You know, and a spider movement is more often than not something you're looking directly at, but it just kind of scuttles around the periphery. And I thought that was a really interesting thing about how in movies often it's kind of these flashes of the unseen, and maybe it has to do with that.
And I also think something like in The Ring, in either version, Ringu or The Ring, and the way the girl coming out of the well moves, it's human. The movements a human can do, but they're not natural. Same thing if anyone has ever seen Wreck, that scene towards the end, that is also traumatic.
Don't give anything away. I actually haven't seen that. I know.
Andrea Subisati. Okay, well, you need to see it for reasons we're going to talk about later in the podcast.
We'll have to do a podcast on it.
Oh, my God. And we could do the sequel. Oh, okay. Okay, I'm on track. No, I'm on track. This is good. So, the uncanny, as you can tell, has a lot of different, can be applied in a lot of different ways. So it's a very interesting theory. I encourage you guys to take a look at it for yourself because, again, it can be applied to a lot of different things, and it's really worth taking a look at. Now, the next theory we're going to talk a little bit about, I'm going to kind of relate it back to my own research, but it's this theory of simulacrum, and that is a copy of the real. So, if, for instance, that could be something like a painting of a photograph. So the original product is the, let's say, a person, and then their photograph is taken, and then someone aims to do a very lifelike painting from a photograph. So that's kind of, it's the copy of a copy. Now, there is a theorist called Baudrillard who had developed a theory from which was simulacrum to simulacra.
I don't know about the rest of you out there who have sociology degrees who just got like chills and maybe broke a sweat, but I'm with you. Baudrillard. Baudrillard and Foucault, they just make me wince.
I thought there was like a really scary story attached to one of them, but no, I spent many sleepless nights during my MA trying to understand it and recently trying to reteach myself this stuff. So it's fuck them. Fuck those little fucking frogs.
Old white men.
Fuck them. Not like literally, but you know, figuratively, like fuck the man or damn the man, I should say. So simulacrum to simulacra. So the kind of essence of it is that a copy is not real, but it becomes its own truth and it has its own right to exist to a certain extent. So the first step is a basic reflection of reality, so something like a photograph. Second step is a perversion of reality. Third step is a pretense of the real with no model. And the fourth step is bears no relation to any reality whatsoever. So that's when it becomes its own truth or own existence. Now, in some of the research I did when I was writing my part of my thesis, which was about horror movies that are based on supposedly real events, spoiler alert, none of them really are. They're all pretty much made up or very, very loosely based on an actual story. So I use the Baudrillard theorem in examining The Exorcist. So the first step, which is a basic reflection of reality, would be the Blatty novel, which was supposedly based on true events of a priest who conducted one of the few successful exorcisms in the United States. The second step, which is the perversion of reality, is the fictionalized script that Blatty wrote, which changes the boy who is exorcised to a young girl who has an actress mom who's shooting a film, and these two priests would their own internal life. Now, the third step is a pretense of the real with no model. So that, I posited, was the supernatural goings-on that supposedly happened during the shooting and the editing. So that was injuries on set, people dying, and then images showing up on film that when they were in the editing suite that couldn't be explained. Quick side note, I actually interviewed Linda Blair recently, and she talked about how this was pretty much a very big fabrication. She didn't come out right and say that, but she always said her experience was very happy, that William Friedkin, the director, was very much in control of everything that was going on set, and she felt like it was a very safe, positive, fun environment. So take that for what you will. Back on track, back to the fourth step, which is the subject bears no relation to any reality whatsoever, and that is the final product of The Exorcist and the audience's reaction to it, which was, you know, people, Linda Blair had death threats. There were cases of one man sustained heavy injuries while watching The Exorcist in the cinema because he threw himself at the screen to, quote, get at the demon, which he was convinced was in the screen. And if he threw himself at it, he would have for sure got it, which, you know, moral of the story, you throw yourself at a screen, you're going to break your arm and your leg. So that is so that's how we take one kind of basic truth, one element of life, and it extrapolates and extrapolates and extrapolates until it becomes a fictionalized version, and we hang a lot of our anxieties and our own personal fears on that one kind of linchpin.
Right, and I think we're going to see that. We're going to be able to see this in a lot of the movies that we discussed today about how everything just goes from the real into total abstraction, and that's when things make us uncomfortable. So to get started with that, our first interview, our first qualitative data measure comes from Paul Korup, who you might know as the creator of Canucksploitation.com, which is a website about everything you ever wanted to know about Canadian B films, and then some. And he is also my co-curator of the Black Museum, which is a lecture series that we've got running out of Toronto right now, as a matter of fact. It just started last week. So we asked Paul to chime in on some movies that scared him most, and this is what he had to say.
The one film that kind of disturbed me a lot growing up was actually a Disney live action movie from 1980 called Watcher in the Woods. Now, aside from going to the drive-in on occasion, I didn't really watch a lot of movies growing up. All I really watched was Disney movies that they would show on TV in the wide world of Disney kind of showcase on Sundays. I guess probably around 1984, my parents got a VCR. Finally, I had the chance to watch some different things, but my parents would still often rent live-action Disney movies like The Parent Trap or Shaggy Dog just to kind of keep my brother and I occupied. Now, the thing you have to understand about Disney in that era is the VHS releases were these huge white clamshell cases that had Mickey Mouse on the cover in his Fantasia getup and the big logo. And then a little lower, they would have a still from the film and probably the title. But really, the Disney logo was as big as the title of the film. So my parents were often renting it for that, you know, what they saw as the logo, and not really paying much attention to the film itself. Which in this case was a kind of a problem, because when they left and kind of waved to my, you know, my brother and I, see you later, enjoy the film, they probably didn't realize what an effect it might have on me. Now, the film itself is about two girls, and their family moves into an estate home in England that's owned by a character played by Bette Davis, who actually appears in one of her final roles. While they're living there in this creepy old manor, they learn that Betty's daughter disappeared about 30 years ago, and the eldest daughter, played by Lynn Holly Johnson, starts to have these visions of this young girl wearing a dress and with a blindfold on every time she kind of walks by a mirror and takes a glimpse in the mirror. That's unnerving in itself, but as the film keeps going, it tends to get creepier and creepier. There's a reenactment of this game that these kids play where Karen actually goes missing that takes place in kind of a gothic church. The scene that really got me, though, was this part where Lynn Holly Johnson's character actually goes to a fairground and goes into a hall of mirrors, and while she's in there, she sees Karen, the little girl, her image multiplied thousands of times, and she runs out. The glass in the funhouse all shatters, and it's a very memorable kind of image. I've probably seen movies like Dracula and Frankenstein at this point in my life, but I'd never seen something with imagery quite so macabre, and it certainly stuck with me. Now, this film, aside from those kind of scary images that it has, it really just kind of also hit some of the stuff I was very interested in. My parents, although they did not really like horror movies and would never really rent them, they did like kind of old dark house style comedy mysteries of the time, such as Private Eyes and Transylvania 65,000 and Murder by Death. So I watched a lot of those movies with secret passages and kind of paintings where there's eyeballs, the eyeballs of the painting are moving because somebody's hiding behind the painting watching you. And this kind of was well within that genre, I felt anyways, with the old estate home. And how it's just so atmospheric and disturbing, and these kids kind of exploring that house and exploring all its dark secrets was something that really appealed to me at the time. So this movie kind of combined that narrative that I really liked with images that kind of went beyond what I'd seen before. So although I liked the film a lot, I also found it pushed the boundaries, so it definitely made a big impression on me as a kid, and it's not a big surprise that it did. John Huff, the director of the film, had previously directed one of my actual favorite Disney movies, live action films called Escape to Witch Mountain, which of course isn't about witches, but is about psychic aliens, of course. But really, John Huff was already a horror legend. He made The Legend of Hell House in 1973, and he imported a lot of that kind of creepy house stuff that he had used before into this film. Interestingly enough, after this movie, he came up to Canada and made a movie called The Incubus, which is about demon rape. So this was kind of this one sort of family-friendly Disney-style horror film was kind of a one-off in his filmography. And I was reading online, apparently, that when Disney first released the film on VHS, that they used to have a disclaimer before the movie saying, this movie is not appropriate for younger kids. You know, it's meant for slightly older children. Of course, if that actually came up during the VHS copy I watched, my parents probably had already left to go grocery shopping or whatever. So that didn't really do me much good. But regardless, I think it's definitely one of the films that has led me to have a lifelong appreciation for the horror genre.
So there you have right there is a perfect example, that Hall of Mirrors example that Paul describes of Baudrillard's Simulacrum, where it's just kind of a scene that's made really uneasy due to all the false reflections of reality that are then shattered. And I think what's really interesting about what Paul had to say is that indeed there are several children's films that have a lot of really scary elements. For example, if you mention the words Return to Oz to anyone in their early 30s, they will just have chills. That movie scared the snot out of so many of us.
I'm not in my early 30s. It still fucking scares me.
Now I feel old. But anyway, I actually watched it again recently, and it's genuinely creepy. The overall premise of the film is creepy. It's a really dark view of Dorothy and her plight and having to get electric shock therapy and how that just kind of bleeds into this fantasy world and that queen with all her heads. A lot of this kid stuff is really scary stuff. And I mean, I'm not going to advocate that I wish I hadn't seen that and I wish I hadn't been scared by that. And I'm happy that Paul developed a healthy fascination with the macabre, or else we wouldn't be where we are today. But yeah.
I also thought it was interesting when he was talking about how his parents liked movies like that. So he kind of had a familiar structure for the narrative, but it was all kind of inverted and perverse. So again, that kind of it feeds into not only the Baudrillard theorem, but also Freud's The Uncanny.
Something happened in these woods. Something that has never been explained. And it's happening again. Now.
Hurt yourself?
Oh, it's just a little cut.
What sort of person are you? Sensitive? Do you sense things?
The past pursues the present like a recurring dream. What began as a game ended when a young girl vanished into thin air.
That was my daughter's name.
What do you think happened to Karen?
I think she's still out there.
Karen is trying to come back.
What did you see? Not Karen outside there. Don't you understand? It's someone else.
Only Jan can help Karen. But who's going to help Jan? Betty Davis, Carol Baker, David McCallum, and Lynn Holly Johnson.
Whatever happened to my Karen could happen to you.
The Watcher in the Woods.
Our next guest, who was kind enough to give us an email response to this, we are very lucky to have the fearless leader, the editor-in-chief of Rumorg magazine, Mr. Dave Alexander, who contributed when we kind of started asking around if people would be willing to share. So it's very cool of him that he took the time to do this. And this is what Dave had to say. The Blair Witch Project got me like few other films because I'm a sucker for the mockumentary format. I love the story's immersive mythology. I've always been fascinated by abandoned buildings and scared of getting lost in the woods. But mostly, it gives my imagination just the right tools to really hammer away at the primal center of my brain. Creators Dan Myrick and Ed Sanchez made me imagine things in the dark much worse than they ever could have captured on film or video. Those fuckers.
So that's excellent. It's an excellent choice. It's a supremely scary movie. But one thing that we're going to get into when we talk a little more about different people's picks is the importance of context when it came to seeing these movies. Now, I saw The Blair Witch Project with my entire family, which, if you knew my family, that is such a rare... I think that's the only time in my entire existence of being that my entire family has gone to see, because it was a holiday and we were sufficiently sick enough of each other, and the movie had been out for a long time, so all the hype was out, almost the spoofs were out even, and so we went to see it prepared to get scared out of our minds. And but because of all the hype, and maybe because of my age, and because I was there with my folks, it didn't really scare me. I had to come back to it a couple of years later before I was able to realize everything that Dave has mentioned in his little blurb here, that it is an absolutely terrifying movie.
I think I went to see it with my dad. No, I did go to see it with my dad, because I remember he seemed very kind of unimpressed with the whole thing. But I was just at that age where I could kind of get all the marketing, and I'd heard enough about it, and I'd caught The Curse of the Blair Witch, which was the fake documentary they produced alongside of it on the Space Channel here in Canada. I believe it aired on Sci-Fi in the States for all our statewide listeners. And I knew going into it that it was fake. I was aware. I remember there was a Time cover story coming out about the actors and that they were on the cover, so obviously they were not missing. But it scared me to the core. That was another one where I was just lie awake and I was scared to close my eyes and I was scared to open them, much like Heather, I believe, says in the movie. It just was so, it got me to the core because it allows your mind to work. And I think it's one of those movies, especially on initial impact or when you get like a real shot at it, when you get a real chance to view the movie, once you allow your brain to kind of relax and work with the film and accept all the kind of the shaky cam and this and that, it can really get at your core fears. And I think it's a great way to kind of hold a mirror up to yourself.
The Blair Witch Project is also one of my favorite examples of less is more in filmmaking, and about how, you know, just the little glimpse you have. You would never think that such a brief glimpse of someone standing in a corner could be the most terrifying thing you've ever seen. But the film was so effective in that regard, and it's a cue that I wish more modern filmmakers would take.
And I will link this again to our Facebook page, but Mr. Dave Alexander actually wrote a great piece a couple years ago when it was the Blair Witch's 10th anniversary for Rue Morgue, interviewing the directors, interviewing Michael Williams. It's a really great piece. So if you are interested in the Blair Witch Project, that's, I would say, is like necessary reading. So I'll post a link to that so you guys can track it down for yourselves.
Also, if I could shamelessly plug my own lecture series and my co-host's upcoming lecture at the Black Museum, Alex West is actually going to be presenting on found footage horror, and I'm sure the Blair Witch Project will be featured in her presentation. So if you're in the Toronto area, be sure to check that out on April 18th at the Big Picture Cinema. So if you can come out to that, do. If not, listen on. It's all you get.
Oh, sorry, I was just waiting for applause after my name. No, it's not coming.
I can edit in some canned applause if you like.
Really?
Or some oohs and ahs.
Will it be there at the lecture? Just some canned oohs and ahs?
No.
Fuck. And next up, we have our friends at the Rewatchability Podcast. Now, I have to say, this is one of my favorite podcasts. I look forward to it every Thursday when it comes up on my podcast feed. I have been a guest a couple times, one time to talk about The Faculty, starring Josh Hartnett, and the second time, a bit more recently, to talk about The Craft. And so these guys were nice enough to share their scariest movies with us. So that is Blaine, JM, and Rob. Please listen in closely, because they do actually talk about some totally not rehearsed, but they talk about simulacrum and the kind of have essence of the uncanny in there. And they also talk about the return to Oz. So they were right without even knowing it.
Hello, this is the Rewatchability Podcast. We're here discussing our movies that scared us.
Mm-hmm.
For me as a kid, the movie that scared me as a kid and still scares me now is Toys.
The Robin Williams movie?
Yeah, where they like have those, like the kids are playing with the toys and they're making an army with the kids. But what scared me most about it was like
how hairy Robin Williams was.
Sasquatch.
His knuckles. And then I turned into him when I got older and I became
Robin
really,
bit me.
Really hairy. Yeah, on a full moon. It was weird.
He was on a lot of coke.
Yeah. No, but the sets were so, yeah. There was no outdoors. It was all like painted to be outdoors. And it was so like the simulacra. That's like, I don't even know what that means, but
yeah, no, I know what that means.
It's like a Tolkien book, right?
It's like the kind of like
Foucault.
Yeah. The fake realism. Like it's supposed to be
you
real,
but
it's
not. You can't
even
tell what reality is or some shit.
Yeah. It's like a casino. Right. And like, yeah. I just hate that feeling of not being near nature or around nature, but it's meant to be nature. Yeah. I hate that.
That was a huge bomb, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a bomb. And they
there was
built
no good
bombs.
Toys from it. That was a problem.
Barry Levinson directed it, I think, right?
Yeah, that makes sense. So that still scares me today because I just get a weird feeling from it. Jam?
Also, you were saying Event Horizon, really.
Oh, yeah. Event Horizon, just because they rip the guy's jaw out at one point in like a scene that you're just kind of watching on the side. It's like a recording of what the crew went through, like when they went to hell and back in the sci-fi movie. And the guy just reaches up and rips the guy's jaw off, and that's terrifying to me. I don't think a mandible can come off that easily, but maybe it can.
Maybe it can. Well, we'll try.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Yeah. After the podcast,
I'm not sure. There haven't been a lot of movies that are consistently scary from like when you're a kid, and now there's a lot of movies I see for the first time now that scare me, or you know, like a movie like The Shining that seems to sort of get scarier as you get older, and
right,
because it sort of plays more to those fears. But like
become Jack Torrance more and more.
Yeah. You know,
Widow's Peak.
We're recording this podcast at a hotel.
Chalet.
Shut for
caretaking.
Actually, it's a Swiss chalet that's closed for the winter.
Also haunted though.
Yeah.
And no booze.
But we just did a podcast about Return to Oz, the Walter Murch movie. That terrified me as a kid. And watching it now, I kind of went into it like, oh, now I'm not a kid, so I can see how silly and fun this is. And it is terrifying. Like, there's a scene where there's a room full of disembodied heads screaming at a small girl. Like, I'll stack that up against anything in Event Horizon.
And the small girl herself is terrifying.
Because she's through as a ball.
Yeah.
And she introduces the DVD.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is also
crafty.
Scary.
Yeah.
What about you, Rob?
I was gonna say the Burbs because that doctor always scared me, but I was just thinking like the image that's always scared me as long as I can remember is the image from the movie The Good Son, where like Macaulay Culkin and Elijah Wood are both being held like from a cliff face by the mom, and like she can only hold one of them, and she's got to choose whether to drop her own boy Elijah Wood, who is the good one, or her stepson, who is Macaulay Culkin, who's the bad one.
Well, one of them would go on to be a lot more profitable.
Yeah,
than the other.
Yeah. Like, do you drop Frodo or like Kevin?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I was just worried that I was going to be the bad one, you know? Like, I would be the one that would drop, like, Mom, come on!
Yeah, yeah. No, you would definitely be the bad one, I know you.
Although that's kind of like a fun thing to imagine, like, scurrying around with, like, your brother like that, like, doing really evil things to him, and then when your mom comes over, being like, hey, we're just hanging out!
Yeah, it's cool. Yeah. I totally never did that with my siblings. Keep quiet.
And you can find their podcast at rewatchability.com. So thanks again to the Rewatchability guys for your contribution to the chat. Next up, we have a contribution from a certain Heidi Honeycutt, who you may know from such ultra-popular websites as planetfury.com. And Heidi has this to contribute to the topic. Her answer is, without a doubt, Halloween, 1978. I think I was 5 the first time I saw it on TV, and back in those days, on network television, they did not edit as much violence and nudity out of movies, only the cussing, and it scared the crap out of me. So much so that I would have nightmares that Michael Myers was standing outside my window, staring at me with his William Shatner albino face, just like he does to Laurie in the film.
The thing about Halloween that is creepier to me than almost any other horror film is that so much of the horror happens in broad daylight. An ordinary sunny afternoon or daydreaming out the window at school becomes absolutely horrifying. The viewer becomes a prey animal stalked by a menace that has the audacity to appear on a suburban sidewalk at 2:30 p.m. in the afternoon. It's fucking chilling. And, you know, she's absolutely right. That aspect of that movie is especially terrifying. It's something that's going to come up when we talk about my scariest moment. But thank you so much, Heidi, for that.
I remember having that feeling when I initially watched Halloween when I was younger, and I was trying to educate myself with all the important horror movies, and the guy at Rogers Video up the street from me told me that was like the one to watch, and I remember it actually scaring me quite a bit. And then if any of our regular listeners remember coming back to it as an adult, it really didn't have much of an effect on me, but that's what it is. And yeah, big thank you to Heidi. She is the editor-in-chief at Planet Fury, where I'm one of the staff writers, and she is awesome sauce. So you should definitely go check out that website. She's also contributes to Fangoria and I think now Famous Monsters, and she's just around. And she's also the lead programmer at the Viscera Film Festival. So she's just fucking amazing.
So our final guests on this topic come from our friends at the Rumorg podcast, our great rivals, apparently, for podcast stardom.
Yeah, there's like a street war between us.
So here is Stuart Feedback Andrews and the unflappable Last Chance Lance and the movies that turned them into the monsters they are today.
All right, this is Feedback from the Rumorg podcast.
And this is Lance, also from the Rumorg podcast, the number one horror podcast in North America and possibly the world.
Certainly in Mumbai.
Do not be fooled by other substitutes, like the show you're listening to right now.
So what horror film scared you the most, Mr. Lance?
Wow, you're really putting me on the spot with that. As I can say that as my life progressed through the decades, that there was different
the
movies.
Many decades.
Many, many decades. There were different movies that scared me. However, the movie that scared me the most, especially as a child, was It's Alive.
Pray tell.
Well, welly well. I do remember the ads for it alone.
Okay.
I'd be downstairs with my sister watching it, just watching TV, and then the ad would come on. And it was this ad with a baby's bassinet with a kind of ding, 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 ding. Like a mobile spinning as the bassinet turned around slowly and they were talking about, it went something like, the Hendersons just had a baby and the only thing that they're upset about is that it's alive. And as the bassinet turned around, you saw these two deformed talon-like claw things that were obviously a baby's elongated, mutated fingers. That scared the living crap out. My sister and I would both go running up the stairs to my mom and dad's room, just like screaming. In fact, the movie scared me so much that it wasn't until the year 2005 that I actually watched it for the first time. And then I was just like, what the fuck is this? It's like they're fucking Muppets. Like, this is bullshit. Why? No. But then I saw the trailer again recently, and I felt the shivers go up and down my body just remembering that fucking horrible, gruesome trailer. Just, oh, still to this day.
The Davises have had a baby, but they're not sending out any announcements. Most new parents are a little scared when they have a baby. The Davises are terrified. You see, there's only one thing wrong with the Davis baby. It's alive. It's alive. Don't see it alone. Please. Rated PG.
That's a great story.
Thank you.
You know what you should do is write that up and put it on Kindertrauma. Do you know about that website?
Kindertrauma?
Yeah.
The scaring of children?
People sharing stories of horror films that really freaked them out when they were kids. And there's a whole, like, litany of...
See, you live in responses. A day and age where people think they need to share all that shit with other people and strangers.
Well, what the hell do you think we're doing right now? I just spent 5 minutes yipping on that buddy, fucking microphone.
I'm just talking...
You're just too lazy to type this shit out.
That's a big part of it. But when I'm doing this thing, I'm just talking to you. What you do with it afterwards, I have no fucking idea. You go and put it on the internet. That's not my problem. I didn't push any buttons to do that. I'm just having a talk with you. We're sharing some cheese and Coke. You know, we'll just go on about our various problems with our girlfriends, and then I leave.
I have a somewhat similar anecdote.
But we're out of time. Sorry. Over to you, Andrea.
A film that really actually freaked me out just from the ad was The Beast Within. I really bought into the advertising, which said something to the effect of, you will not be able to sit through the last 15 minutes of this film. And I read about it in Fangoria when I was a kid, basically, and I really bought into the hype, the advertising hype, and the images in the article were fantastic. I finally watched the movie, absolutely loved the film, but I had so convinced myself that the advertising was real, that even though in the last 15 minutes it's just a guy with a like really fake-looking rubber head being kind of inflated with a bicycle pump, I convinced myself that it was the goriest, most disturbing thing I'd ever seen because I was so willing to play along. Could you imagine me at that stage, that impressionable stage, being willing to play along with such a thing?
Actually, I can't imagine that because I can see you wrapped up in a 20-foot-long, multicolored Tom Baker as Doctor Who scarf with your Blake 7 t-shirt, clutching a Simon the Land of Chalk Drawings lunchbox.
Exactly. With the Psychomania leather jacket.
Oh, this is your rebellious stage? You're like Kenny Everett video show Sid Snot kind of thing? Yeah, okay. Right.
The Buggles' greatest hits.
Boy, all of England lamented the day that you left and came over to Canada.
Warning. This preview cannot show all of the terrifying and grotesque transformation sequences from the last 30 minutes of The Beast Within. The filmmakers strongly suggest that those who may be shocked by this unique, horrifying movie use caution when seeing the film. Been warned. You are dared to remain calm during the horrifying final 30 minutes of The Beast Within. Even you may not survive. You have been warned.
But the film that definitely, without a shadow of a doubt, freaked me out when I was a kid was Jaws.
Really?
I saw it when I was a kid in the theater.
Ah.
And you know what actually fucked me up the most? I mean, beyond the whole thing of a shark in the water, I still can't get into a body of water, even a lake.
Probably
even a great lake where there are no sharks. Probably I think there's going to be one. Sorry, are you trying to interrupt me? This is my time.
You asked me a question. You said...
I mean, you're like yipping in.
I know, but you asked me...
Let me finish. Jaws, but what fucked me up the most was that thing with the head rolling out of the boat. When he goes under the boat, he pulls out the tooth and the head rolls out. I was terrified I'd open up a closet and a head would come rolling out, or I'd open up a drawer and a head would be sitting there looking up at me. I mean, I was really freaked out at the prospect that that would happen.
Well, I bet you were freaked out, because when you actually have to open the door and come out of the closet, it is a scary world out there. But I have to say, I think what probably freaked you out the most in that movie was that there was a naked woman in it.
At the beginning?
Yeah, when she's...
And why would that freak me out?
Because you've probably never seen one before.
I'm not the one who's terrified at the sight of naked female flesh. I think we've established that.
I'm terrified at the sight of lots of... A lot of people have
heard your commentary over the Coffin Joe movie, and a lot of speculation is flying around the internet right now as to like what your exact pathological condition is. Not your sexual orientation. We know what most that of is. That, yeah. Latent homosexual suffering with a premature onset of homosexual panic. There's nothing wrong with that.
How many times could you say homosexual?
There's nothing wrong with that.
I'm glad you say so, you know? Yeah.
But there's a deeper pathology at work. It's like Buffalo Bill from Silence of the Lambs. He wasn't really a transvestite. He thought he was a transvestite. He actually just despised his own body.
Hey, I'd fuck me.
Well, there you have it, Faculty of Horror listeners. Movies that terrified us.
Podcast gold. You should be so lucky to get this from anyone else. Try getting that from the fucking Toothless Wonders at Horror Pit or whatever down there.
I don't think they'd be so giving of their time.
What, are we getting paid for this? Or is this like
of
a charity?
Of course. Okay, I assumed so.
That's fine. You can have them anytime you want then.
If you'd like to hear more of Lance's illuminations on the horror genre and various other miscellany of totally irrelevant bullshit, come and check us out on the Rue Morgue podcast at www.rue-morgue.com.
So, for start, I haven't seen either of those movies, I'm afraid, gentlemen. I haven't seen The Beast Within, and I haven't seen It's Alive. But upon listening to your podcast, I looked up on YouTube, I looked up a trailer for It's Alive, and I found a 3-minute one, and it's a trailer of absolute nonsense. There is absolutely zero plot going on. There are hysterical doctors being like, get out of here, open the door, give me 5 cc's of blah, 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 blah. And then there's a cop shooting and a couple of cops shooting and people running and a car chase. And there's just total pandemonium that doesn't, it barely even implies that there is a monster child.
Was George Clooney in there? Because it might have just been an episode of ER.
I wish. I looked for him, but definitely no hunky police officers or firefighters or...
Damn it.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so, and then I did another search and I was able to find the trailer that Lance is talking about. And I read on the Wikipedia that It's Alive actually, it came out in 1974, but according to Wikipedia, the film was a financial failure in its initial release, and it was later reissued with a new ad campaign, including that trailer that Lance had described. And that trailer was enough to drive people to check out the movie, and it earned $7 million in domestic rentals. So so Lance is just kind of a casualty of that renewed ad campaign that totally changed the face of this movie.
I kind of came around to that actually ass backwards. I believe there's actually a remake of It's Alive, which I saw, because I think it was on Netflix, and I think I checked it out one night, and I thought, this is awful, and I thought I remembered it being a movie from the 70s or 80s. So I went back, found the original, watched that, and it's really pretty goofy, and actually, I think, as Lance describes, and then I eventually just checked out the campaign, because I'd heard something about the campaign, and that trailer is far more horrifying than the actual movie, so I'm totally on board with that. And I think what's interesting about what both Feedback and Lance have to say is that they both had those moments of fearing a trailer, which I think is really interesting, and certainly some trailers are enough to send me over the edge. And it's just, it's that tease, it's that moment. It's like a microcosm of the Blair Witch. As we were saying earlier, the kind of darkness and the emptiness in the Blair Witch is where our mind fills in the gaps and we create the fear. Now, I think what Stuart and Lance were both kind of getting at is that the trailer hints at the horror, and then our mind fills it with something more terrifying than it could ever possibly be. So, of course, the final product is a bit of a letdown. Usually a lot of films these days, it's just a bunch of CGI things, you know, popping up. I remember recently I saw the trailers for Sinister, and I thought, what a freaky movie that's going to be. And I was so excited to go see it. And I actually wound up going to see it by myself because I really wanted to enjoy the whole experience of it, of being scared and freaking out. And it just kind of turned into this big, huge CGI goofy mess that I really, really hated. It was probably one of my least favorite films of last year.
It's okay that you couldn't get a date, Alex.
Well, you wouldn't come with me.
I know. Another interesting thing about trailers is trailers are kind of, I feel like they're an artifact of production that have kind of a confused place in cinema right now. I do have cable at home, but I do most of my viewing on Netflix and DVDs and rentals that I get a hold of. So I don't watch, I don't get to see nearly as many trailers as I used to. And also, a lot of the movies that I see in the theater nowadays are because it's an important something in horror. For example, obviously, I'm going to go see the new Evil Dead, regardless of...
Oh, really? Because I already saw it.
Yeah, I know you already saw it. Everyone already saw it. I'm going to see it with the rest of the friggin' plebes on opening day. But anyway, situations like that, or at film festivals, or even Rumorg's Cine Macabre, you know, when the programmer is someone that I trust, that I don't care what the trailer says. I've learned to not necessarily trust trailers, and trailers are, for me, less and less important factor on A, whether or not I see the movie, and B, whether or not I think I like the movie, because trailers have deceived me so many times over. So I think it's really interesting that both Stuart and Lance had this build-up to make reference to for their scariest moments.
Well, shall we do it? Shall we reveal ours?
I think we've put it off long enough. You go first.
Fuck. You're always one step ahead, Super Saddy. All right. Okay. I've already gotten flagged for this choice just this morning. My film is Pet Sematary. Now, it's not the whole of Pet Sematary. It's fucking Zelda. It's Zelda. It's the demented sister of the wife who appears in basically two scenes. And she's suffering from spinal meningitis. And that scene... Okay, I'm going to back it up a little bit. So I initially saw Pet Sematary when I was probably about 11. I was at a sleepover, as I was talking about earlier, and we didn't finish it because one girl was crying too much, and we decided it was best that we don't finish it. And it ended off, I think, shortly after the second time Zelda appears and is all like, I'm going to twist your back like mine. And oh my God, I was so happy that girl cried so much so we could fucking turn that movie off.
Finally came back for you, Rachel. I'm going to twist your back like mine so you'll never get out of bed again. Never get out of bed again. Never get out of bed again! Never get out of bed again!
And I remember going back to my house, which was kind of the next street over. And my parents had left a note saying, oh, we decided to treat ourselves to breakfast. We're out for breakfast. Drop your stuff and you can come meet us if you're in time. Otherwise, we'll see you soon. And my room, my childhood room up in my parents' place, was the renovated attic. And I remembered taking my bag in my totally silent house mid-morning, going to put it up in the attic. And for some reason, I posited Zelda as living in the attic, not in a back room. I had her in the attic in my head. And my body tensed to a point I can't explain. I was, again, 11, and it just tensed. It would not move any further. I got halfway up the stairs. I dropped my bag, and I ran. I ran out of my house, this house I've known for so long. I ran, and I met my parents for breakfast, and I don't think said a word to them about it, and was just terrified. I had nightmares for weeks. It was not fun. And since watching the movie recently in the last couple weeks for this podcast, I've been having weird panics and weird moments of Zelda. She's going to jump out of me from a closet and give me spinal meningitis.
Smile.
in sympathy of Alex, and if she had to relive her worst nightmare movie, I decided to relive it with her. I watched it recently, and I watched it again just this morning. And, you know, my reaction this morning was the same as when she initially told me that it was her scariest movie. I was kind of like, really? You know, it's not a movie that I consider very psychologically scary or even very, you know, or the makeup and the effects and the gore factor. It's an excellent movie. Upon the rewatch, it's brilliantly executed and really well written and well cast. And
well, except for Dale Midriff or whatever the fuck his name was. He's awful.
Judd?
No, not Fred Gwynn. Fred Gwynn is the best. Judd is the best. Lewis. No, the doctor.
You don't like Lewis?
No, he's awful.
I thought he was all right. In fact, I thought he was pretty hunky. When I was watching it this time, I finally recognized him from The Stand, where he played Larry Underwood. And Larry Underwood's character was kind of a ladies' man. Like, he got all these chicks. And I think it was when he had to play a doctor for me to be like, oh, right. Anyway, for me, like, Zelda is a wonderful example of the simulacrum we were talking about. Did I just pronounce that right? She's a wonderful example of that because she exists in Rachel's memory. And when Rachel is talking about it, she is telling her husband about it in a time of crisis. So this is a really huge memory for me. This is my childhood trauma that has to do with life and death. And it is a very traumatic event in her life and the way she recounts it. So obviously in her memory, and this is like a copy of a copy, there's what she registered as a child and how her mind kind of distorted it in adulthood into this monstrosity.
And I think it's interesting because I watched the movie a couple of times recently to get myself over the fear enough to watch it and be able to talk about it. But Zelda is such a small part of the film, thank Christ. But I think it's the trauma that the mother experiences that causes all the effects of Pet Sematary to unravel themselves. So it's basically the mother who introduces her fear of death, which introduces Lewis, who goes and buries their cat once it gets hit by the truck, in the Mi'kmaq burial ground. And it gives Judd, the neighbor, again, the wonderful Fred Gwynn, the opportunity to kind of say, well, there's another way around death, because he senses that there is some kind of panic around death in this family. And had the mother not experienced Zelda, the events of the film might not have occurred. So it makes sense that this character appears twice briefly, but very effectively.
I've heard in an interview, the Rumorg founder, Rodrigo Gudino, say, and very rightfully so, that our culture has a very unhealthy relationship with death. And a lot of cultures have death mythology that, you know, is kind of positive, or it posits that our ancestors are close to us in some way and we recognize them and believe in them in really positive terms. Whereas in the West, you know, death is something that we really like to remove ourselves from and repress. And I thought Pet Sematary spoke to that really brilliantly. For myself personally, I actually killed one of my pets.
What?
I accidentally killed one of my pets as a young teenager, and I repressed it so strongly. It was several years later that I guess something made me think of one of those stupid little budgie birds. And I was like, oh, I used to have a budgie, I killed it. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. And yeah, I remember it happening and I was totally hysterical. And the power of repression is really scary, how I can just push it out of my mind. And you would think I'd be pretty messed up after that.
Can someone come get me? I'd like to go home now. I think there's something, I find it very odd for me that I had so strongly believed, it's a small thing, but I'd so strongly believed that Zelda was kept in the attic, not in a back room, which is where she actually is, just kind of like a room to the back of the house. But no, I put it in the kind of room that I had. And it's very strange to me that I would have done that, because I'm a pretty practical person. Horror is probably the weirdest aspect to myself. I mean, you can talk to my ex-boyfriends, maybe they'd know better. But there is something about, I must have wanted to posit something in a way I could understand it, or I don't know, maybe I felt like I was being put in the attic as a child.
But I mean, you probably saw, is that like, did you talk about coming upstairs and her being behind you?
The way my room was laid out, still laid out, is there's a set of stairs that go up to the room, and there's a landing, and right when you come onto the landing, that's when you see the bed. So that's why I would only get halfway up the stairs that morning, because I was convinced Zelda was on that fucking bed. I was convinced she was on my bed, and that she was just going to start like screaming or doing something. I didn't know what she was going to do, but it was that fear. And actually, I was looking a little bit into Stephen King, obviously, since he wrote the novel and then the screenplay of this, and he has a brief cameo in it, and his take on fear, because I thought it would be very important for this podcast. And he said, fear is an emotion that makes us blind. And it was like I was willing myself to be blind with only coming halfway up those stairs. I just couldn't, again, I was 11, so I'm not trying to be hard on myself, but I just couldn't take those extra steps to see my bed because I was so scared of what I might see.
Yeah, that article by Stephen King is really, really excellent, and we will definitely post that to share, which actually segues nicely into my personal worst cinematic fear, because it's also a Stephen King. And I'll preface this by saying my childhood in horror, I didn't have a lot of girlfriends who were into horror, so I was kind of on my own. And I also had two sisters growing up, so I didn't have a whole lot of access to the TV with the VCR. So all I could get my hands on were books, were horror books. And I remember we used to have this bookmobile, which was a big van that was kind of an offshoot of the Ottawa Public Library. And this bookmobile would come to the parking lot of my elementary school once a week, Tuesdays or Wednesdays or whatever. And I used to go, and I had a note from my mom that permitted me to withdraw adult books. And I just chewed through every Stephen King novel there was in that bookmobile. And when I ran out of those, I started going to the real library. And when I ran through those, I read them all the fuck again. I loved them, and I can talk about the characters in these books as if I know them, because I feel like I do. And the book that scared me the most, and consequently the movie that scared me the most, was It.
Wait, It? What It?
I knew you were going to do that. Yeah. Not playing this game, you friggin' vaudeville.
This is why you don't have friends in horror, because they say shit like that.
Well, this is why you don't have friends at all. So anyway, I was at a sleepover with two girls that I never hung out with. This was a really one-off random sleepover, and we decided to rent It because we were told that it was really, really scary. And so we rented it from the local video store, and this was back in the VHS days. And It was a mini series. There are two parts to it, and both parts are, I don't know, 2 hours and change, I guess. So the entire VHS set was like four or five cassettes and humongous. And I distinctly remember the artwork was just this bleak black, and then the giant letters I and T in red, and then there was kind of like a grate and a little claw coming out. God, I'll never forget it. I've got chills right now. So anyways, we put on this movie, and we're like, yeah, we're going to watch a scary movie. We're going to get so scared. Yeah, it's going to be great. And we put it on, and the first 2 minutes of this goddamned movie, you've got this adorable little girl riding her trike in the rain, and she hears something, and she's looking, and she's got her laundry is hung up on a nearby, whatchamacallit, what are the,
clothesline.
God, because we're talking about this movie, and I'm forgetting English. There's a clothesline with these sheets flapping in it, and she sees the clown, and he kind of smiles at her and waves, and he goes, hi, and then she kind of smiles, but then when she looks again, you get this other briefest glimpse of him again, and his smile is gone, and his expression has just slipped a notch into totally sinister.
Come on, Lorianne, it's gonna storm!
Hi.
Hi.
I just, as a kid, I just lost my voice. All three of us went completely silent. And that was before the credits even go on. And I think all three of us were thinking the same thing, like, oh, shit. What have we started here? Anyway, as the film goes on, the first part of the film I maintain is excellent. I love it. I love the story. And I thought part one was brilliantly executed. Part two is awful. It's almost unbearable to get through. But I'm sure my sleepover didn't even make it that far because that's what, I don't know, 5 hours into our lives. We probably started at like 7. You know what I mean? So I don't even know if we got that far. But that opening bit scared the bejesus out of me. I haven't had a fear of clowns ever since. But that particular glimpse of him in the sheets would come to me when I was coming up my basement stairs. And my parents made me run down to the basement quite a bit. My mom would be cooking and she'd ask me to kind of go get,
So was it when they had company coming over?
What?
That you'd have to go down to the basement.
Oh, no, I mean, she'd make me run down to grab something, be like probably a giant can of tomatoes from Costco or like a giant thing of my dad's homemade red wine. Like whether we were having company or not, we drank a lot of fucking wine. Anyway, I used to go down the stairs, and when I used to come up the stairs, I would go up them so fast, like sprinting as hard as my legs would allow, because as if there was something behind me on the stairs. I remember I would take the stairs 2x2 until I became strong enough to take them 3x3. This was probably the beginning of my my nice roller derby legs right now. But yeah, that scene has never left my mind. And I knew that when I was trying to watch it again for the sake of this podcast, that it would have to start with that scene. And once I got over that scene, it was getting over the hump. The rest of it was fine. Part two was nothing, but it was difficult.
And may I say, those are shapely legs. So it's interesting to me because we both, our fear is centered around a set of stairs in our own personal life. So do you think it's an anticipation of something you might see? And especially for you, do you think it's someone showing you one face but actually meaning something else?
Do you know, I've tried really hard to overthink my fear of that scene the way I overthink everything else in the universe. And I really haven't come up with it. I mean, in rewatching it, I had a new kind of level of horror in that opening scene. The little girl's mother was kind of like, well, what the hell was her name? Kellyanne? Kellyanne! Kellyanne, come in! It's raining! And she went in for a second, and then her child is gone. So in rewatching it, I was just kind of like, holy shit, that child died 10 feet from her mother, really gorily, and in the entire movie, actually. Like, just this beast that preys on children was kind of extra chilling for me. But I've got no problem with clowns, per se. I've got no problem with drains or whatever. I have a problem with spiders, which was really a stupid part of the second part of the movie. I think stairs might have to do with, stairs are kind of a vulnerable thing. Like, when you're growing up, you're told to really be extra careful on stairs.
And I think it speaks to the point I was mentioning about Stephen King, where it is a big blind spot for us. It is a literal blind spot for us. When we're coming down a set of stairs or coming up a set of stairs, we're about to see something and we don't know what we're going to see. Now, for me, when just as Andrea had her laugh with Pet Sematary, I had my laugh with It. I get scared fairly easily. It has never scared me. I watched it when I was a kid. I thought it was stupid then. I saw it, and it went on for a very long time. It is a very long investment, and I take that as an investment into my friendship with Andrea. Now, perhaps it's I want to give credit where credit is due. There is another great podcast out there called Alco Hollywood. I'll link them as well. And they did a podcast about It, and they mention Pennywise is kind of being this Mighty Morphin Power Rangers-esque villain where he kind of jumps around and taunts, you know, the kids, but never actually does anything. And I'd listen to that podcast and then rewatch the movie for this podcast you're listening to right now, and I couldn't get that image out of my head. And I was like, yeah, he's just taking turns taunting them. He's not doing anything. For me, it didn't affect me, but it is that kind of strange space where the threat occurs and actual violence occurs. Mm-hmm. And so it's that anticipation and that weight. And I think if you're intelligent and sensitive, you can fill that void with a lot of things. Mm-hmm.
Right. And just like you said about how, you know, Zelda wasn't actually a menacing figure physically. She was a menacing figure psychologically in that she could frighten you and you had to take care of her and you would potentially blame yourself if she died under your care, as was the case for Rachel, which was really harrowing. I did preface my scariest movie moment with the fact that I had read the book. And if you've seen the book, it is as big a book as the VHS case was of the movies. It is a huge book because as long as it, the movies were, the backstory on the town and the characters and peripheral characters that aren't even in the movie is huge. It has a whole own universe. From the beginning, from what the children understand to what happens in the second part, it gets very abstract and very kind of fantasy-like. For example, their final showdown with that spider. I remember reading the book and being like, how can there even be a movie version of this? Because so much of it goes on kind of in Bill's head, and there's another entity that they call the turtle who is kind of helping them out. The turtle is the... I know, God, it sounds so stupid. But basically, there was a lot more at work than they were able to depict, which is kind of a shame. But I'm sure my reading of the books infected my reading of the movie. And I'm hoping there are other people out there who have had the same experience who can say, you know, I saw the movie and then I read the books, or vice versa, and how that affected whether or not the movie scared them.
And I think it's when Andrew and I were talking about doing this particular topic for a podcast, and we both kind of looked at each other and just said, this is my scariest movie, this is my scariest movie, and we both were like, Stephen King. I'm not a big Stephen King fan. I'm not to the extent that Andrea is. She just lent me The Shining, so I'm working my way through that now. And I think there is something that King does that speaks to our vulnerability. It speaks to us when we're physically vulnerable and when we're emotionally vulnerable. So whether it's in something like The Shining, when you know, you're physically remote from the rest of the world, and you are, you know, I think kind of the audience conduit is either Danny or Wendy, and you're at the mercy of this kind of tyrannical other half. So I think he's really great at putting the character that you want to identify with in the most vulnerable and emotionally tenuous position.
Wendy, I'm home.
So that's it. Those are our scariest movies. Those are the reasons why we think we get scared. We want to hear from you. Why do you get scared? What movies scared you? Have they changed? Do you still get scared? Let us know. You can get us at thefacultyofhorror@gmail.com. You can also message us on Facebook. We're just Faculty of Horror on there. You can find us. You can also get us on Twitter. I'm at ScareAlex.
And I'm at Necromandria.
And we're always on there, so you should get us, because we really would love to hear from you. We are looking at doing a kind of feedback episode coming up, probably in the next few months, not immediately. And we'd love to include some of that stuff on there. We also want to thank some of our other podcast friends. As always, Modern Superior for having us on their network. 6 Foot Plus, they're a fantastic podcast full of all kind of great music. I listen to it now all the time, courtesy of Andrea, who turned me on to them. Mill Creeps podcast for giving us a very lovely shout out, and they talk about really great movies that are basically in DVD bargain bin stuff, and they're really funny and they're definitely worth checking out.
I want to give a huge thanks to everyone who contributed their thoughts and secret fears to this episode. We know it's not an easy thing to do, and once you put it out there, you have to defend it. So big thanks to Paul Korup, Dave Alexander, the guys at Rewatchability, Stuart Lance at the Roomwork Podcast, and Heidi Honeycutt.
And an extra special thanks to, let me just find this bottle. All right. Woodbridge Cabernet Sauvignon, fuel of this episode of the Faculty of Horror, courtesy of a Mr. Ron McKenzie, care of Roomwork. So big thank you to those guys there. Yeah, and as we were talking about earlier, the Black Museum is on now. Where can they find stuff about the Black Museum, Andrea?
You can check out our schedule at www.theblackmuseum.com.
I will be giving a lecture on April 18th. If that's not enough, they also serve beer there, so you can come have a beer and listen to me talk. I'll be talking about found footage horror. My lecture is called Ghosts in the Machine, the Evolution of Found Footage Horror. I will be talking specifically about movies like Cannibal Holocaust, The Blair Witch Project, The Ring. What? Maybe there's a bridge there. Maybe you should come see this lecture to learn how it all fits in. Rec, Paranormal Activity, and The Last Exorcism.
So yeah, until next time, stay in touch, and we'll talk to you soon. Office hours are closed. Under the outdoor with the steamboats, ancient goblins and warlords, come at the grand light making a sound. The smell of death is all around. And at night when the cold wind blows, no one cares, nobody knows. I don't want to be buried in a pet cemetery. To the sacred place. This ain't a dream, I can't escape. Moldings and fangs that are picking up bones. Spirits moaning among the tombstones. And at night when the moon is bright, someone cries something ain't right. I don't wanna be buried in a pet cemetery. My life again. I don't wanna be buried in a pet cemetery. I don't want to live my life again. I feel a chill. Victor is grinning, flesh is riding away. Skeleton dance, I curse these days. And at night when the wolves cry out, listen close and you can hear me shout. I don't want